I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A terrific read is the new book by Jeff Meggs and Rod Mickleber, The Art of the Impossible, Dave Barrett and the NDP in Power, 1972 to 1975. Jeff Meggs joins me now. We'll talk about the Barrett government and the times that are chronicled in this book. The beginning of the book is a wonderful overview of what the province was like before 1972, what the W.A.C. Bennett years were like. As well, the authors do a good job at contextualizing what was happening outside of British Columbia. Often the contrasts were striking. The personalities in and around government are fascinating, and of course the record kept in the book of the landmark pieces of legislation is informative and useful. Jeff Meggs is a city councillor in Vancouver, elected in 2008 and re-elected last year. He was communications director to Glenn Clark when he was premier, and Larry Campbell during his time as mayor. He's written two previous books, Salmon, The Decline of the West Coast Fishery, which won the Lieutenant Governor's Medal for Historical Writing, and Cork Lines and Canning Lines. He edited The Fisherman, another book as well. This new book is published by Harbor. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program Jeff Meggs. Councillor Meggs, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, in the last several weeks or so, you wanted to run for provincial office. You sought the NDP nomination in Vancouver Fairview, but lost. In the course of writing this book, did you think that the Barrett years were exciting times and perhaps that you wanted to be part of, say, an Adrian Dix government?
Well, I certainly hoped I could be part of an Adrian Dix government, and I was tantalized by the possibility, but I think that the experience of researching the Barrett years, which I started doing long before I had any aspirations to elected office provincially, I sort of learned both the good and the bad, a cautionary tale and an inspiring one at the same time, about what can and probably should not be tried in political life.
So this book can be useful to Mr. Dix and the NDP, right?
I think so. I hope it is. It's it's important history because it hasn't really been spelled out before. It's strange. When Rod Mickleber and I decided to write it, it was in part because no one had told the story since a very quickly done book right after the Barrett government when it was defeated. And so over the passage of years, it's easier to make a much more comprehensive assessment.
Mm-hmm. Now, the election in 1972, by all objective accounts, it was a transformative election, because it was the end, it was the last campaign to W.A.C. Bennett, and it was the election that elected Dave Barrett. What was it like on the hustings? I mean, I guess Bennett was tired, and Barrett, well, he's always been a great orator, right?
Well, Barrett was a great orator, but he was deliberately underplaying his cards, determined to try to catch the social credit folks off guard, and he was still very alert to the problems that had beset Tom Berger, the previous NDP leader, who had gone to the polls against W.A.C. Bennett in 1969 with the slogan "Ready to Govern," and the New Democrats and their base had firmly expected to win in 69 and suffered a shattering defeat at the hands of W.A.C. Bennett, who was in his late 60s, and Berger lost his own seat. And that was a curtain raiser for what happened in the Barrett campaign, because Barrett firmly rejected any suggestion he was going to form government and tried to keep it lighthearted and low-key and, in fact, campaigned well away from the main cities for the first couple of weeks. It was a summer campaign. It was hot. There was a salmon strike that year, and people were distracted, and people finally went to the polls just before Labor Day.
And then when the NDP won, I guess Barrett and Bob Williams, they were at the only sketching out the cabinet on the back of envelopes, right?
Yeah, they didn't have a transition plan.
Yeah.
They had their platform, but this was a party that had been formed in the late 30s as the CCF, and then been transformed in 61 by the creation of the NDP, which was sort of a merger with the labor movement. And in all that time, they had only come close to government once during the Second World War. So there was just no culture of preparation for taking over government and no serious plan to do so.
And then once in government, it was quite a reforming time. I mean, can you count the number of pieces of legislation that they passed in those 39 months?
Well, we got to nearly 100
initiatives
and pieces of legislation. The pieces of legislation numbered over 300, but lots of them were administrative and I think we got 97 in the book that were not legislation necessarily, but laws, actions, policies, investments, you name it, that they carried. It was so intense for a while that the media called it legislation by thunderbolt. But even while legislation was going through the House, they were making fundamental changes in all kinds of other areas.
And then, for one, I guess, reform in the House. I mean, there's question period finally and answered, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to realize now that W.A.C. Bennett presided over a completely backward legislature where the sessions were only held once a year. There was no Hansard. There was no question period. The bureaucracy was minimal. The opposition had no offices. Only the leader of the opposition had an office in Victoria. Everybody else shared desks in a single big room and went home at the end of the session. If they really got a debate going, W.A.C. Bennett would just keep it going around the clock until he toppled over from exhaustion. The press gallery was on the take in many cases, accepting contributions from social credit cabinet ministers to write speeches, and that had its own impact in the columns they were sending into the interior. It was completely out of step. You've got to remember, this is the 1970s, and on the we were soon to have Watergate. The Vietnam War was raging. The 60s had been a period of turmoil. Feminism was rising as a huge social force, and all of that seemed to be happening in a distant planet as far as the BC legislature was concerned.
Yeah. So a couple of the pieces, the initiatives of the Barrett government that remain today, they did not come about peacefully or quietly. I mean, there was great opposition to them, but they've lasted. I mean, I'm thinking of the Agricultural Land Reserve and ICBC.
Yep, those are the two that everybody mentions. Ambulance service usually comes next. Yeah. We didn't have a provincial ambulance service. And I think it's important to keep in mind that we talk about things being transformative, but it was transforming a very backward situation in so many ways. A lot of the things that Bennett had stopped from happening were already happening in other provinces. And Barrett did not do things, frankly, that were that different from what was happening in other jurisdictions. He just did them faster and in a more decisive way. The fact that he basically held his share of the popular vote in spite of 3 years of unparalleled controversy demonstrates that he was pretty true to his base, even though lots of them were furious at him by the time the election came along.
And then the percentage of the vote, didn't it increase up to 1983 when he was in the
Yeah, he was able to continuously increase the vote. And, you know, the fundamental factor of BC politics has always been the question of unity on the center and the right. Mm-hmm. And the NDP has only succeeded when there was a split on the right. But that was the case certainly for Mike Harcourt, who was the next NDP premier after Barrett, who dearly had a bit of a scare because Gordon Wilson and the BC Liberals, as they then were, much closer to today's federal Liberals, became the third party in the legislature. It was social credit was destroyed in that election, reduced, I think, to two seats. The BC Reform Party had a couple.
Yeah.
It was out of the ashes of the collapse there that the powers that are in BC took the BC Liberals and turned them into the new right-wing party.
Now, does Barrett, in your book and in his book as well, his memoirs, does he talk about his part in how polarized British Columbia politics are?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Barrett's book, in spite of his pride in what was accomplished, his book is pretty candid and self-critical in ways that are surprising, I think, in a politician of his stature. But he was self-critical on a number of points, so some of the specific actions that he took or did not take during his term of government, but also the polarization which had turned BC politics into a bipolar situation of right versus left, socialism versus free enterprise. He felt was really a loss. I mean, he came into politics when there were four viable parties. Social credit had the BC Liberals there and the Conservatives, both of which were much more analogous to the federal counterparts. It wasn't the situation we see today, where everybody to the right of the NDP is in a single organization. And Barrett regretted the polarization and took some responsibility for it happening.
And does he blame the media, though? I mean, you're someone who's worked in the media.
Oh, yeah. Of course, everybody in politics blames the media to a degree, and he did, and with some reason. I think that we were able to document in the book, as I said, that the press gallery, and everybody knew this who was around it at the time, was substantially in the pocket of the government, and some of the so-called independent reporters were actually on the government payroll, at least part-time.
Mm-hmm.
When Barrett got in, though, a huge wave of additional reporters came to Victoria because it was the best story in Canada for a while. The Vancouver Sun expanded its legislative bureau several fold and put in charge a woman named Marjorie Nichols, who was one of the top journalists of her period. But she was openly, and her biography makes it very clear, her autobiography, she was a conservative by political preference.
Mm-hmm.
She's been very hard on governments of all stripes, but she certainly had no time for anything to the left of center. There was also a huge dominance in the media then, which continues surprisingly to this day, of three or four key reporters who controlled a huge chunk of the BC audience. So Nichols had the Sun. She was the bureau chief, and she was very close to Ellen Fotheringham, who was a key Sun columnist.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them were very close to Jack Webster, who was the lead open line show person. And open line is starting to fade in BC, but it's hard for people today to imagine how decisive it was. And they also were all close to Global, which was already emerging as a powerhouse on the TV scene. So if you had a story that was reported in a similar fashion by the Sun, Webster, Global, you could have you had them coming at you from every direction, and it was very, very difficult to combat. However, Barrett never had a plan to deal with that. He always he had no media strategy. He had no consistent polling. He had none of the tools that would be commonplace today.
Now, in terms of the relationship with the Bennetts, I mean, he admired W.A.C. Bennett, but the relationship with Bill Bennett, that was non-existent, right? They hated each other.
I've never seen any evidence of any relationship with Bill Bennett. Bill Bennett came along, and they sneered at him. They underestimated him. They called him a daddy's boy, and all of those cracks, which seemed pretty funny at the time, but they were not laughing very hard after Bennett pulled together the Social Credit Party in such a cohesive way. One thing that Barrett had never expected, I don't think, is that the BC Liberals, who had been in opposition as long as the New Democrats, would actually join Social Credit for a chance at a cabinet seat rather than continue in opposition. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, Pat McGeer, who 2 years earlier had been the leader of the BC Liberals, crossed the floor in 1975, or 3 years earlier, he had been the leader.
Yeah.
Crossed the floor and eventually became a cabinet minister in Bill Bennett's cabinet, as did Gardy Gardam and a couple of the others.
Yeah. Say, but will there ever be a book on the Glenn Clark years? I mean, you were part of that. I mean, is that something you'd want to do one day?
Well, I was pretty close to it, so I don't know if I'm the right person to do it. I don't know if I would want to. There's been one book done by Judith Tabji about his downfall, but there ought to be more books written on BC politics.
Indeed.
But I can tell you it doesn't pay.
Really? Yeah. At the outset of the term, when Barrett was elected, he asked his cabinet if they wanted to be there for a long time or a good time. I guess they decided that they would be there for a good time. Looking at it objectively 40 years later, I mean, was it a good time for BC?
Yeah, it was a good time. And by that they meant not a party time,
right,
in the sense of partying, but doing good things. And that's the name of the book is drawn from a quote by Václav Havel, the Czech president, who said we should teach ourselves and others that politics can be the art of the impossible, namely the art of improving ourselves and the world. And they felt they were doing that, and that they would have very little time to do it, that they were kind of insurgents. They'd broken down the fortress of social credit, and they were going to finally do the things that they've been waiting to do for so long. And so much of their work has endured. I mean, one of the things that Rod was able to do at the end of the book was interview David Mitchell, who is one of the top BC political historians, who's reassessed the Barrett government. He was very dismissive of it in the 80s as a glitch, and Barrett was a loser and so on. Now says it needs to be acknowledged as a turning point in the history of the province. So I think in retrospect it clearly was.
Did you enjoy working with Rod?
Yeah, we've been old friends, and it worked well. Rod had been on the scene as a reporter, and he brought a sense of anecdote and color to it that I didn't have. I moved to BC right after the Barrett government fell, and he was able also to bring in some of the personalities that others might have missed, you know, some of the deputy ministers and some of the other political staff who often aren't around. We also made an effort to talk to party activists and to a lot of the other smaller players who I knew were significant, but who normally wouldn't make it into a book like this. So, I was really happy with the product, and it's getting a great reception.
Yeah, it's a great read, and it doesn't, when you give two authors on a book, sometimes you can tell which author did which, but you guys speak in sort of one voice.
Well, we had a great editor in Silas White,
yeah,
who was remarkably knowledgeable about the period. It's a we agreed completely on the tone we wanted to set. We had some debates about some of the conclusions we were drawing. I was went into the book annoyed at Barrett for legislating unions back to work because of my own labor background. But at the end of the book, I kind of was more sympathetic to his decisions. On the other hand, I went in. More supportive of what I thought he had done and came out more critical on a number of fronts, particularly the kind of ill-planned and chaotic way they executed the government agenda. I mean, there were times they lived the dream of a premier, which is they had the capacity to spend vast, huge lifts of money. I mean, it's kind of reverse of what we see today, where the premier has just announced that, the deficit's going to be three or four times what they thought. Barrett was able to increase spending by double digits and balance the books because of a gusher of resource rents and things that were coming in, and the economy was growing for the first part of his term. And it's hard to believe, if you've ever been in government, the opportunities he had, and some of them I think were squandered. On the other hand, nobody's come close to achieving what he did, so it's a bit of a mixed assessment.
When I had brought on a little while ago, he said that Dave Barrett's not doing too well. Have you gotten a reaction to this book from him?
No, and we both have talked in the last few days to people who visited Dave in the last couple of months. I knew that he was getting on and that his abilities were diminishing, so it's a shame. He's not really able to participate or respond to politics anymore, and really completely withdrew from public life after his 80th birthday a couple of years ago.
Really, yeah. Did you guys had fun doing this, and it seems like you did.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think Rod did too. It was a project that kept producing new surprises for us as we met more and more of these personalities from that period. And maybe people who grew up in BC knew, that Norm Levy had fought in Europe and then fought in a captured British tank in Israel, as it then was Palestine. And we had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting public personalities of our era, and this was the last chance to do it. Many of them are in their final years, obviously.
Yeah, and we get to meet people like Bob Williams or Rosemary Brown, Bill King, which I mean, they, as you said earlier, wouldn't make a book on their own, perhaps. Or Rosemary Brown did, but getting to know what it was like for them.
Well, one thing that's striking is that they were young.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm just showing my own age, but the Barrett government was dominated by people who were overwhelmingly in their 40s, who already had a really significant record of achievement, and many of whom went on to very significant further achievements. I mean, Barrett defeated Tom Berger, and he replaced Tom Berger as leader of the NDP. We argue in the book that both of them can be counted among the preeminent public figures of their generation. And it doesn't take anything away from the current leaders of any political party to say that the quality of people who provided leadership in those days was really remarkable. And they were in the prime of life, and they had enormous energy, and they did great things for the province.
Would you come back on the program one day to talk about municipal politics?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
I've enjoyed this conversation. This is a great book. I hope it does well for you guys, because it is a necessary read for a lot of us that are interested in history and in politics and the sort. So congratulations on it.
Joel, thank you so much, and thanks for having me on.
The book is called The Art of the Impossible, Dave Barrett and the NDP in Power, 1972 to 1975. It's from Harbor Publishing, co-written with Rod Mickleber. Jeff Meggs on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.